back to the program. I am greatly pleased to introduce our next guest. He has been a passionate voice in the global warming movement for quite a while. I've been aware of him for almost a decade now. As Assistant Secretary at the U.S. Department of Energy Office under President Bill Clinton, Dr. Joseph Rome helped to manage the largest program in the world for creating energy efficiency. Currently, the MIT-trained physicist is Executive Director and founder of the nonprofit Center for Energy and Climate Solutions, also a Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he oversees the blog climateprogress.org. His new book out this month, Hell and High Water, Global Warming, the Solution and the Politics, explores the current administration and advocates a very different direction, as you might imagine. Welcome, Dr. Rome.
Hello.
Now, your book takes a premises that we discuss frequently here on EcoTalk on Air America, as you might imagine. But give us the most egregious examples of what you call the irresponsibility of the Bush administration in terms of censoring legitimate information about climate change.
Well, under law, the administration was supposed to do an assessment of the impacts of global warming on the United States, and it has refused to do that. It actually asked the Competitive Enterprise Institute in the first term to sue it to remove the assessment that it had to do. And, of course, I've talked to many climate scientists, I'm sure you have, who have been muzzled, who've been told not to talk about impacts with the public if they work for the federal government. And it takes someone with the courage and reputation of James Hansen to sort of blow the whistle and let us know that, in fact, this muzzling is going on, and
yes,
it's just absurd.
Widely discussed here on EcoTalk. Have no fear. So, just what else stands out to you, I guess, in terms of what has gone down that should never be the case, given the severity of the crisis?
Yeah. Well, I think what's really sad is, you know, the Bush administration has done everything they can to block the follow-on to Kyoto. They have done everything they can to, you know, set up this phony Asian partnership, which doesn't have any commitments at all.
And voluntary measures will do it.
Voluntary measures will do it. And I have a whole discussion in Hell and High Water about the clever rhetorical strategy that they use, not just to defeat the science, but, and I think you'll be hearing this upcoming in the State of the Union, but how they love to talk about new technology. New technology is the answer. The implication is, of course, that existing technology is useless. And of course, one thing I say is they only like technology that doesn't exist. As soon as it exists, they don't like it anymore.
I noticed that. I noticed the title of your book, Hell and High Water, not Hell or High Water. I'm sure that was perfectly intentional. Is that what we're facing if we don't make an eco-U-turn real quickly here?
Absolutely. You know, I think basically global warming makes dry areas drier and turns them into tinderboxes, and makes wet areas wetter and turns them into areas that are deluged, like Katrina did to New Orleans. And I actually wrote the book because my brother lost his home in Pas Christian, Mississippi, because of Katrina. Mm. And so you get the combination that we're seeing of dry areas and record wildfire seasons sweeping the country. So that's sort of the heat and the dry and the wildfires is sort of the hellish side. And the high water side is the sea level rise that people have seen Al Gore's movie, and the tremendous growth in the number of destructive hurricanes, which is expected under climate change, and which we're sort of starting to see some evidence now.
Okay, and you mentioned Al Gore. You were acting Assistant Secretary at the Department of Energy under President Clinton, as we mentioned. Looking back, do you think that President Clinton did enough for the environment? Did he listen carefully enough to Gore's environmental warnings and his advocacy? I understand that they met regularly when both were in town on Fridays and would have lunch, and Gore would sort of educate Clinton about global warming and other issues that he was concerned about, but perhaps didn't speak loudly enough at that time. But that's all history now. But what do you think as an insider?
Well, there were a lot of people inside the administration who worked for the economic agencies who were dead set against any action at all. So it was a big struggle to get even the commitment that we got going into Kyoto, where Vice President Gore went in and kind of saved the day and negotiated a deal. But I think if there was any failing, it was allowing this Senate vote that was 95-0, the Byrd-Hagel Amendment, which left people with the impression that the Senate was unanimously against Kyoto, which was not the case at all. But look, this is a tough thing to negotiate because it affects every single aspect of what we do. You know, the houses, the energy we get in houses, cars, businesses, and so on. So I always say it's not easy to achieve the reductions that we need, but it is straightforward. It is only a matter of spending the necessary money. And I think, you know, perhaps we didn't make the case well enough to the American people that the rich countries in the world have to go first. That's a responsibility of ours. That's something we agreed to back in 1992. There's this perception in this country that we shouldn't go unless every other country takes action at the same time. And, you know, if you ever talk to people in China and India, they wonder why the rich countries, which got rich doing all this pollution, refuse to take even modest first steps.
And after all, we are the superpower in terms of what we emit as far as CO2. We're the biggest contributor at this point, even though China's gaining on us. So that alone, you'd think, would make us required to act aggressively.
Indeed. But, you know,
you would think.
This administration, you know, the Bush-Cheney or Cheney-Bush administration, depending on how you look, you know, is been very retrograde. I have a posting, actually, on the American Progress website called Why Historians Won't Warm to W, which, you know, says that Bush thinks his legacy is going to be Iraq and historians will view him favorably. But in fact, in 20 or 30 years, people aren't going to remember Iraq. They're going to remember, they're going to be living in a much worse climate, and they're going to remember how Bush thwarted all serious action on climate. And so his legacy is going to be, assuming we don't reverse course sharply after he leaves office, is going to be, you know, hell and high water.
And you're not one of those who predicts he's going to wake up and smell the CO2 and realize that this is the one thing that can save his presidential legacy is getting active on addressing climate change?
I would love to see a Nixon goes to China type of thing. But realistically, here's a guy who spent an hour talking to Michael Crichton. You know, that's his science
fiction. Science fiction writer.
Science fiction writer. So he's, instead of having a science advisor, he has a science fiction advisor.
And he refuses to see Al Gore's movie. I mean, just how stubborn and head in the sand is that?
Indeed. No, you know, this is a administration driven by I guess sort of an ostrich complex, a refusal to see reality and just desire to stick one's head in the sand.
And that's the theme song at the top of our program, which you missed because you're coming on midway. So I want to get to the three solutions that you outline in your book to global warming. That's certainly where we need to focus is, okay, what do we do about it?
Well, the top priority, you need to set up a cap and trade system. You have to just cap greenhouse gas emissions in this country and allow trading, allow the free market to set the price for carbon. Because until carbon dioxide, which is the primary greenhouse gas, which comes from the combustion of coal, oil, natural gas, until you have a price for that, it's going to be very hard to get the kind of reductions that are needed. As in terms of policies, I think the most important thing that gets neglected is energy efficiency. You can really do a lot. State of California, among others, has kept per capita electricity consumption flat for three decades, while the rest of the country, it's gone up 60%. And that's a pretty impressive achievement, especially given that they don't have higher energy bills than the rest of the country. So we need to aggressively push energy-efficient technologies into the marketplace. And the last thing is fuel economy standards. I mean, we've done nothing for two decades on fuel economy standards, and the average vehicle in the U.S. fleet is actually less efficient than it was two decades ago. So
I'm glad you brought that up. How about Ted Stevens being an advocate suddenly for improving CAFE standards? How has he been inhaling a lot of greenhouse gases or what? I mean, this is an encouraging turn. What's behind it?
Well, Alaska is the state that is suffering the most visibly today from global warming. And it's just, you know, entire villages, I think over 100 villages need to be relocated because they are near the shores. And the shores are rising and getting warmer and the villages are becoming unlivable. And the permafrost is melting and huge holes are forming in the ground and trees are falling over and highways are crumbling. So,
in fact, we're going to have a firsthand account of that in our next segment. It's going to be a woman who lives in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Oh.
And she was at Al Gore's training session, as I was recently. And she was there because her neighborhood is buckling from melting permafrost. She lives right down the street from those drunken trees.
The drunken trees, yes. Well, and that you also have the insomniac polar bears. You have the bears aren't hibernating. And, of course, you have the Inuit culture up there, and which is being radically changed. So it's impossible to live in Alaska and not see a dramatic climate change. The planet is warming up 2 to 3 times faster in the polls than it is down here.
Okay, so even Ted Stevens sees it.
Yes.
And then on the other side, we've got Barack Obama introducing a coal-to-liquid fuel promotion act of 2007, which has many environmentalists scratching their heads and shaking their heads and saying this is not good for global warming. It may or may not be good for getting off foreign oil. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything worse than coal to oil. And I've written a lot and talked a lot about it. But, I mean, fundamentally, it has twice the emissions of regular oil. And I think the senator has been just got some very bad advice, and hopefully people are going to start to talk to him and explain to him that coal to oil is an irredeemably bad idea.
Sounds pretty decisive there.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the last minute or so, you wrote a book, The Hype About Hydrogen, a few years back. What do you think about hydrogen's prospects now?
Well, Jim Woolsey, CIA director, summarized it, the book, in 6 words. Forget hydrogen, forget hydrogen, forget hydrogen. It's just not that practical to make a hydrogen fuel cell car. It's not practical to get hydrogen to the car. I think the car of the future is an advanced hybrid called a plug-in hybrid that can charge up off the grid and drive 20 or 30 miles all electric, and that would cover a lot of commuting distance for most consumers. Hydrogen cars are, you know, the distant future. I doubt your listeners are going to be driving hydrogen cars anytime soon.
Dr. Joseph Rome, always a voice of wisdom, and your new book, I highly recommend it, Hell and High Water, Global Warming, the Solution and the Politics. Stay with us. When we come back, we will hear from a woman who lives in Fairbanks, Alaska, and is quite concerned about what's going on outside her front door.